You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Martin Sheen and his son Emilio Estevez have worked together on many film and TV projects, including Apocalypse Now, The West Wing, The War at Home, and Bobby. But perhaps the most personal was The Way, a movie that was released last year in which Emilio directed his father as a man attempting to fulfill his son's last wish by walking the 500-mile Camino de Santiago in Spain. Now the two have teamed up to write a dual memoir called Along the Way, The Journey of a Father and Son, in which they chronicle their family history in alternating chapters, framed by the story of the making of the film, which is now available on DVD. The book is published by Free Press. I'm very pleased it has brought them both to our show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard. Thanks for having us.
And Martin, I know a lot of people are already familiar with the story, but perhaps we should begin with the names. You were born Ramon Estevez?
Yes, and that's still my name. I never changed it officially.
Oh, so yeah. On your passport, do people get confused?
Yes.
They say, don't you look, like Martin Sheen, don't you?
It's still a problem, yeah. I refuse to change it. I love my name.
But you felt you needed to change it at the time to have a film career?
Yeah. But, I started here in New York in the theater in 1959, and there was an awful lot of prejudice against the Hispanic community, specifically the Puerto Rican community, which I identified with and loved. But
even though your family was from Spain.
Yeah, though we're all connected, you know. But I was having enough problems trying to get a job as an actor, and I thought, well, maybe I'm being led somewhere. So I changed it. I sort of invented Martin Sheen. I used the name of a casting director, Robert Dale Martin, who was very helpful to me when I started here at CBS in my early years, and Bishop Fulton J. Sheen, who was the auxiliary bishop of New York at the time.
Were you religious? Is that the reason you picked
I was
it?
Catholic, of course, yeah. But when I grew up, in my teenage years, Bishop Sheen was the first tele-evangelist. Mm-hmm. You know, he would give a half-hour lecture, a moral lecture on national television prime time, and was the top-rated show of the evening. And so I thought of him as an actor. You know, he had this great presence and these cold burning eyes, and I thought of him, he was like a Shakespearean actor, and I thought I'll go with him, you know.
So Emilio, had things changed by the time you came on the scene so you could use the name Emilio Estevez?
Well, you know, I struggled initially with the choice. I was being influenced by agents and managers who said, look, if you use Sheen, it'll certainly be easier for you. That there's already a brand, doors will open for you, and you won't have to explain yourself. People will just, will recognize the name. And I said, well, okay, let's try that. So I had a couple of headshots taken, and photo and resume, of which would have been very short at the time, the resume part. And I put Emilio Sheen at the very bottom of that photo, and I looked at it, and I thought, wow, that just looks stupid. And so he and I had a not a heated discussion about it, but we had a discussion, and he said, "Man, things have changed. And think about the some of the names you've seen over the last few years, Sylvester Stallone, and I think you even brought up Engelbert Humperdinck."
Yes, one of my favorite.
Actually, he changed his name from something like Michael
John
Jones.
Smith, right? So he said, "Emilio Estevez or Estevez sounds." Very
well, how
tame
would you
in
say
comparison.
Estevez or Estevez?
Well, the Spanish way is Estevez, mm-hmm. but the gringo pronunciation is Estevez, and I'm fine with either, frankly.
Well, it hasn't hurt Meryl Streep's daughters, the Gumber Girls, so I guess things really have changed, and people figure it out anyway. Your father, Francisco, was from Spain, from Galicia, so did he speak Spanish?
Oh, God, yes. He spoke...
Galicia.
He spoke both. That's a different language up there.
And Galician, that's where much of the way is set. So was this in a way also a way of honoring your father?
In a very deeply personal way, it was exactly that.
Yeah. But you grew up in Dayton. How did you wind up in Ohio?
Well, my father came to the United States with his a cousin around 1915, 1916, and they had a little difficulty getting in to the United States at Port of New York, so they went to Cuba. And my dad worked in the sugarcane fields for about 3 years, and he came in through Miami as a Cubano. And he worked his way up to Dayton, Ohio, which was the headquarters for the National Cash Register Company at that time. And they were hiring a lot of immigrants. And so he thought that's where he should go. And he did. And he worked for them for about 47 years.
Well, your father was born in the year of the Spanish-American War.
In fact, I thought he was born on the day, July 2nd, 1898, that the United States declared war on Spain. But I learned through the research of this book that it was actually a few weeks earlier. But maybe the word didn't get to Galicia until July 2nd.
And your mother was from Ireland.
She was from a little village called Borsacane in County Tipperary.
So how did they meet?
They met in Dayton, Ohio at a citizenship school. My mother was very, her family was very involved with the Irish liberation movement. And when the Civil War came in 1922, they saw it coming, and she was sent to the United States and
to avoid all of the troubles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You write that you knew from an early age, not that you wanted to be an actor, but that you were an actor.
Yeah, I couldn't identify it, you know, as such until I started going to the movies. I guess I was five or six. I don't recall exactly. But then it gradually dawned on me, oh, I'm one of those people up on the screen. Oh, what's the problem, you know?
So then you have a choice. You're in the middle, well, not in the middle of the country, but you could have gone to Los Angeles or you could have come here. You came to New York.
Yeah, I always wanted to come to New York because James Dean had come to New York, you know, and Marlon Brando and Paul Newman and all my idols.
And how did your family react? I mean, were they proud when you were in The Subject Is Roses?
Oh, very proud indeed, yeah. My dad was a little uncomfortable seeing my name. He couldn't identify with Sheen, and frankly, neither could I. I'm still trying to adjust to it. But
that's right. Your mother was Irish.
He stood outside the theater, didn't he, looking up at the poster?
He did, yeah.
And staring and saying,
so who is
he
that?
Never said a word. Yeah, he retired in 1964, and he'd come through New York. He was on his way back to Spain. He wanted to live out the rest of his life in Spain, and he stopped in New York and stayed with us a week, and he came to see The Subject Was Roses. Yeah.
And then you had Emilio when you were very young.
I was 21, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then your wife soon had three other children. So from the start, you were giving yourself certain problems of balancing career with fatherhood, or were you one of those fathers who said, "Oh, no, the career comes first"?
No, I was in for the long haul. No, I tried at least not to separate us and on any level. But I personally was fragmented in a lot of different ways, but not with family. I adored them, and you know, I came from a very large family. There were 10 in my family. 10 siblings, and so you know, we always just moved over when another one showed up, and that's the way I thought it should be, so that's what we did.
And then you brought the kids along with you, the whole family along with you, wherever you were working.
As often as was possible, yeah.
That was one of the great blessings of my life.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you, what was it like? What are your earliest memories of traveling with your father?
Well, what a privilege, and he insisted every job he got that 6 tickets were provided by the company. So it meant picking up and living out of a suitcase, sometimes for many months at a time. And while initially it was always an inconvenience to miss school, to miss my friends, to pick up and really have a full immersion course in another country, whether it was in Rome for 3 months or the Philippines for 5 months or India for a month and a half or Mexico for 6 months, which is where we moved from New York when my father was cast in Mike Nichols' Catch-22 mm-hmm. in 1969. We moved from the city. I never wanted to leave New York, by the way. I loved it here. Never wanted to leave the city. And there I am in the middle of Mexico.
Not such a bad place to be. And then later Italy for that film as well.
Of course. But so it was a privilege, but it was also the way it was. We were kind of like gypsies.
Yeah, right? But what did other people also bring their kids, or did you feel alone?
Alan Arkin brought his family. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it was rare. And I think that, you know, especially these days, most movie stars have the nannies taking care of the kids while they go off and have these great adventures.
Well, it's rare in
other
ways.
A nanny.
You couldn't afford it. Well, but your marriage has lasted 50 years.
Yes, but I'm only responsible for half of it. You know?
Still, I mean, that's a rare thing.
Well, you know, if you knew her, you'd realize that it was the smartest thing I ever did was to marry her, and the second smartest thing was to stay married to her.
You write that while you were on location in Rome, you decided to visit your father's family in Galicia. Where did they live?
They lived in a tiny little village up in the mountains above Vigo in a community called Patarrubias in Salta Revolta.
You said that very well.
Like a
Gallego. It's the only Spanish you know.
That's about it, yeah. Very isolated at the time.
So it was hard to get there?
Yeah,
it
was.
And did they know you were coming? And it's not like the age of cell phones.
No, my father had sent a letter that I would possibly show up, but it hadn't arrived yet. And we flew in from Rome to Madrid and took a train up to Vigo and came out of the train station in Vigo and got a cab. And I just started talking to the guy. I said, I need to go to Patarrubias. And I was showing him the address that my father had sent me. And he said, Paco? And I said, no, me llamo Ramon. He said, no, Paco, su padre. I said, yes, my father was Francisco. Paco is a nickname for Francisco. And he said he knew my father as a boy. And he drove us right to the door.
But they don't speak Spanish there, do they?
They speak Gallego.
So even if you knew a little Spanish, it didn't matter. You don't study Gallego in high school Ohio.
It's a different language.
And you were long, Emilio?
I was six at the time.
What did you think of these people you'd never met before and the way they lived?
I was intrigued by them. I love the farm and the rural aspect of it. I love the fact that they grew their own food, they made their own wine, slaughtered their own chickens, and provided for themselves. But you learn more about Galicia, and the people were so cut off for so long. That was the norm.
My guests are Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez. They've written with the help of Hope Edelman, Along the Way, The Journey of a Father and Son. And despite the fact that you say, Emilio, you love New York, you never want to leave, you wound up moving to California with the family.
That's right.
Because that's
I had no choice. I'm 6 years old. What am I going to protest and stay? I'm staying in New York.
Kids do protest.
I did. No, I did.
But that's where the work was. And then a big break for you, starring in Terrence Malick's Badlands.
Yeah.
It got incredible reviews. So that led to what, TV work or more movies?
More TV work, actually. The film was not initially a commercial success, although it is the only film I've ever done where I actually got the back end, you know, where you sign on for you know the base fee, the union fee, and in fact I made more in per diem than I did in salary.
It's like
on
residuals.
The 4 months, exactly. And but you sign, and if the film makes any dough, you get a percentage at the end. And it's the only one in a 50-year career that ever paid off at the end.
Because most low budget movies don't make
you
a lot of money, or they do the fancy bookkeeping.
Yeah, exactly.
In this case, Badlands has become such a cult.
It became a
film.
Classic. Yeah.
And then, of course, you were cast as Captain Willard in Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now, mm-hmm. which was filming in the Philippines. Harvey Keitel was originally supposed to play that role, right?
He was playing.
What happened?
Yeah. Well, you know, honestly, I don't know. And Harvey's never told me, and Francis has just said that they had a difference of artistic opinion, and he changed horses midstream. And
well, there were other actors who turned down the role because they just saw it as too demanding.
That's possible. I know that Al was talked about, and Bobby De Niro, Al Pacino, mm-hmm. that is, and maybe Jack Nicholson. I don't know. You know.
But when you look at a script of a film like that. I know some of it was improvised later, but still, when you look at the script, do you immediately know this is going to be an important film?
Frankly, I did because of Francis Ford Coppola. Anything that he was involved in was going to draw a lot of attention. I mean, he was the most popular, was the most brilliant director alive at that time, with the possible exception of Terrence Malick.
This is before The Godfather.
This is
after
The Godfather. Yeah,
one and two.
Yeah, and the Conversation. Yeah.
Oh, The Conversation, one of my favorite films.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so, you write a lot about the time you spent in the Philippines, and we're going to take a little break, and we'll come back and talk about that and other things. And I also want to talk a bit about the winemaking business. Francis Ford Coppola makes great wines, and now, Emilio, you're making wines.
I'm working. I'm sorry I didn't bring any. We could have.
It's
noon, isn't it? We could have actually. Yeah. Well.
Emilio Estevez and Martin Sheen, they have collaborated on a memoir with the help of Edelman called Along the Way, The Journey of a Father and Son. It is published by Free Press. Stay with us. We're back with Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez. They've written with the help of Hope Edelman, Along the Way, The Journey of a Father and Son. It's published by Free Press, and I'm pronouncing your name okay now?
I was going to comment. It was beautifully done. Thank you.
The whole family moved to the Philippines for the shoot. Originally was supposed to be 4 months or so. How long did it actually take?
I sometimes think it's still going on, but only in my head. I started in May of 76 and finished in the spring of 77. I was about 15 months, would you say?
Wow.
Yeah,
and a lot of dramatic stuff. Yeah.
But they were on it much longer, you know, because they were on it a couple of months before I started.
The opening sequence in the film where everything was swirling around and you were going crazy, that wasn't just a matter of great acting.
No. It was,
you reveal great, that you were...
great emotional upheaval, shall we say.
Yeah. You had had a lot. You'd imbibed a bit, and that affected you.
Yeah.
Usually it's not a good idea to drink
Not a good idea. No, I wouldn't suggest that. No,
but it's very effective, so...
Yeah, for what I was doing at the time, you know, no, it's just reflective acting. It's transcendent acting, if you will. It was not acting, you know, bottom line. It was exploring some dark sides of my character that I'd done on occasion, you know, privately, and decided, if this is going to happen, let's take this private pain public just for this one time.
Now, Amelia, what were the conditions? Were you living at least in a decent hotel, or were you living in the jungle?
Oh, we were. We had terrific accommodations. They had put us up in a kind of a country club atmosphere for.
It was more of a camp.
Like, camp, yeah. Yeah.
And wood cabins.
It was on a lake. There were cabins. There were little huts, and we lived very well.
Were you aware of your father going out of control?
I was on the set
that
day. Oh, yeah. No, I was on the set earlier in the day, and then went off. And then came back to the scene that had unfolded and was continuing to unfold, and I of course had seen
freaked
him.
Out for him.
I really wasn't. I thought I was kind of humored by it.
Dad's doing that again.
He's hammered. This is now on film. There was blood all over the room, and a nurse was administering this. This Filipino nurse was sitting by on the bed next to him, and he had insisted that everybody stand around. Everybody, meaning Francis, his wife Eleanor, Gray Fredrickson, the producer, and several others. My mother and I joined the party, and he insisted that we all hold hands and sing "Amazing Grace."
And now, they were off key. Everyone.
Outrageous. And at this point, I think he had.
It's amazing you could tell.
They had gone through Amazing Grace maybe 10 or 20 times, and Francis had it. He says, I'm tired of singing Amazing Grace. I'm not singing Amazing Grace anymore. So we had to pick a different song, and that I don't remember. I'm sure it was of your choosing, though.
Well, if they'd just gotten it right in the first place.
Well, you were holding your heads while Amelia was describing that. So obviously this is something that still brings back bad memories.
You know, look, you know, there was a documentary, a very brilliant documentary, by the way, done on the making of Apocalypse Now. And they sent it to us to watch before it was released.
That's
it
Eleanor, didn't she?
She shot a lot of the footage.
She did the footage.
It was put together by George Hickenlooper.
Hickenlooper, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who also did the bodybuilding film and film about hunting, some other things.
But may I say that they wanted us to see the documentary before it went out, and so I saw all of that many, many years later, and I was watching it with a friend who said, God, that's going to be very embarrassing, that's going to be out there. And I said, well, that's who I was. That's not who I am, so it's a good thing that I know the difference.
And Amelia, you were cast as an extra soldier on the film, first film
We had
role.
A scene together.
That's right, yeah.
And then
yeah.
That wound up on the cutting room floor.
As it happened, yeah, my first film on the cutting room floor, but it was fine. I'm sure I was dreadful.
On the other hand, you spent a lot of your spare time with Lawrence Fishburne, who was the only person around your age. So
Lawrence and Gio Coppola, the three of us became very good friends during the production.
But you wanted to go back to Malibu to go to school.
I desperately needed to. I had responsibilities. I had friends, and 5 months in the Philippines was as much as I could take, frankly.
Now, Martin, while you were making the film, you had a heart attack. You were young and fit at the time, 36
years old. I thought I was.
Do you remember the circumstances?
Yeah. Oh, God, I do, yeah. Yeah, it was quite a wake-up call. You know, I was told that if it had happened at the age I am now, I wouldn't be here. You know, but I was young enough and still strong enough to withstand it. It was a pretty severe blow, but it was the psychological effect, the emotional effect was far more lasting than the actual physical harm.
Well, you couldn't go back on the set for a while.
No, it took about 6 weeks. Yeah.
So they just shot around you.
They did. My brother Joe was brought in. We looked very much alike, and he doubled for me for the time I was gone. And they also did the ending of the film, which Emilio witnessed. I never saw it with Lawrence Fishburne. He talks about it in the film. Yeah.
That's right. And do you know why you had that heart attack at 36?
You know, I've been told that it could have been, my genes. You know, my mother and my father both, and my oldest brother died of a heart attack.
Well, your mother was just died when you were just 11 years old. She never saw you act.
No, never did, no. But I think it was more psychological, you know, and an emotional experience that I gave myself in order to change direction.
Yeah. Well, did it freak you out and the rest of the family? I assume it did.
Well, sure, because you're thinking 36-year-old men don't have heart attacks, and they certainly don't die this age from that type of illness. And so, of course, I was freaked out. And we were in California when he got sick, and then we, meaning my brothers and my sister, and we went back to the Philippines for another month to be with him.
My guests are Emilio Estevez and Martin Sheen. They've written, with the help of Hope Edelman, a joint memoir called Along the Way, The Journey of a Father and Son. It is published by Free Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And Emilio, you were back in Malibu, living near Sean and Chris Penn, Robin Chad Lowe. Did you all know that you wanted to be actors?
Oh, we all desperately wanted to be actors. We were involved in theater, the drama department at school, made short films, 8mm films, often cast the neighborhood kids that were, you know, in addition to Sean and Chris and Rob, other kids that have not gone on or had no interest in going on to be actors or filmmakers. But we always had a keen interest. So, you know, I'm sure most of that is having grown up on film sets and having the opportunity to see wonderful directors at work and having that be a large part of our life experience.
Working with Coppola and The Outsiders, for example.
Of course.
You also did The Breakfast Club, St. Elmo's Fire. At what point did you know that you wanted to direct? Although the cliche is that every actor says,
sure,
what I really want to do is direct.
And then
did
most
you want
of them,
to direct, Martin?
No.
But you've done
almost
it once.
I did it once.
John Wayne did it once.
You did Repo Man, not a bad movie. That's a pretty good movie.
I didn't direct
that. You didn't?
I wished I had.
Oh.
No. So I knew at a very young age that I wanted to be a storyteller. When I was 7 or 8 years old, I wrote a story and submitted it to Universal Studios for the show Night Gallery, the Rod Serling show. And I had written it on school, the notebook paper, and written in pencil. And of course, it was sent back with a rejection slip. So between that and writing a play in high school, and I'd always wanted to be a storyteller.
So you, let's talk about your collaboration on The Way. Your idea?
Initially, it began with my father. He had taken a trip to Spain in 2003 with my son. And they were in the middle of
Your son, Taylor, who lives there now.
Well, he's there now. Yeah, that's right. They were on the road. My father had always wanted to go to visit the Camino de Santiago and didn't have enough time. So he and my son and our good friend Matt Clark, who's also in the film, he plays the priest slash rabbi in the film. So the three of them took off in a car because they didn't have enough time to walk it or ride it by bike. The first town they ended up in was a town called Burgos, which is, as the crow flies, 2 hours north of Madrid on the Camino de Santiago. They checked into a pilgrim's, like a Casa Rural, a bed and breakfast, and sat at the pilgrim's supper. A young woman walked in. She took a look at my son. He looked at her, and they've been in love ever since. They married in 2009. So my father came back from that experience and said, hey, you know, I
have some explaining to do about your son
and why he's not with me. So my son then decided, I'm moving to Spain. I'm going to live there. I'm going to. So if I wanted to spend any time with him, I had to figure out how to work in Spain. So he and I began a conversation about what the movie would be if we were to make a picture in Spain. And I said, well, I think the core of it is about a father losing a son, because I lost mine there. Not tragically, of course, but lost him.
Well, we're talking about the Camino de Santiago, the way of St. James, is the way it's said in English. It's 800 kilometers, 500 miles.
500 miles, that's right.
And people do walk it. How long does it generally take to complete?
I know people who've done it in 4 weeks. Which are moving. These are people who run marathons, of course. Normally it takes about six weeks to do it properly, drink some wine, eat some food, do some sightseeing.
And there must be people who provide housing and food along the way.
Of course.
In fact, it probably is a very nice place to have an inn.
Yeah.
How many people walk it in a typical year?
Well, it depends on the year, because if it's a holy year, for instance, 2010, was it 2000?
Was the last holy year. That's when the Feast of St. James falls on a Sunday.
And you could have as many as 300,000 pilgrims walk it.
Mostly Catholics? Because Shirley MacLaine and some other New Age type people have walked it as well. They say there's some kind of a feeling.
Well, Paulo Coelho had never written a book before he walked the Camino. And after that, he said, my calling is as a novelist, and wrote The Pilgrimage.
Well, Martin, you play a California ophthalmologist named Tom, whose son quit graduate school and started to walk the Camino and then died in an accident on the first day out. Is it a dangerous undertaking?
In fact, when we were doing the recce for the location scouting for the movie, it's exactly what happened in the spot that you see in the film. A young guy from Holland went off the edge in a storm,
got disoriented and walked off the edge.
Yeah.
So they lose a few people.
And you made it as difficult as possible. You didn't shoot it digitally, even though I would think that just because of the rigors of the trip, that would be the best way to shoot a film like this.
I wanted to shoot on Super 16. The DP, we had an entirely Spanish crew. Spanish DP and I talked about, he had just worked on the red cameras. And he said, I think the way to go is Super 16 on this. And I thought, you know...
It
does look beautiful. And I think that that was the proper way to do, shoot it on film, have it be a little grainy. And I think just in terms of the light, I mean, it's hard to go wrong in Spain, right? You point a camera in almost any direction, especially in the north that time of year. The light was just so extraordinary.
You're no longer worried about your heart doing something as rigorous as this?
No.
Tom, go ahead.
No, I'm fine. I do yoga every day. I haven't smoked in years, or haven't had a drink in 20-some years. So, no, I stay pretty fit.
Sounds boring. So at one point, Tom knocks his backpack off of a high bridge and then jumps into the river. And I got the feeling it was really you.
It was me.
It was him.
Right.
We had a stuntman on the set, and he revealed to us on the day that his expertise was not in whitewater rafting or whitewater swimming. It was horses. He was like, no, I don't go in the water. I'm a horseman. I thought, really? Now you tell us.
Yeah. So back in the States, the two of you live near each other?
We do.
In Malibu?
About 200 paces. Haven't you counted them out on your way?
Actually, five.
500 paces. Mm-hmm. Right.
A lot shorter than the Camino. And you have a vineyard.
I do.
Do you see yourself as carrying on a family tradition, or were you inspired by your first director, Francis Ford Coppola?
Well, you know, I was inspired by a water bill that I received. Which was in the hundreds of dollars for watering this ridiculous lawn, which is neither edible or drinkable. There's really nothing you can convert it to. So I said, well, let's dig this thing up. And I remember people complaining, well, you're going to ruin your view. I said, what view? I'm creating
a
view.
You have to have special kind of soil to grow
wine
grapes.
I've learned that later.
The grapes turned out.
After they actually started growing, they said, well, you know, it's impossible to grow anything on this soil. It's very clay heavy.
That's good for wine
but
grapes.
It can be, but there's no real blend of silt and clay, and you sort of, the vines have hit this clay pan and have spread out rather than going deep. So that's sort of the dilemma we're facing right now.
What kinds of grapes thrive from that?
Because we're a coastal vineyard, we can really only grow Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. But Pinot comes with its own set of problems because, as you know, they call it the heartbreak grape for a reason.
Very difficult to grow.
Very difficult to grow, very funky, susceptible to all sorts of mildew and other problems. But I have faith this year. I've been spending a lot of time out there. We're about to bloom. Bud break has been very even, and I'm confident we're going to have a good harvest this year.
Now, the memoir skips over some major points in your careers, like The West Wing,
That's another book.
Oh, The Mighty Ducks could be another book as well.
A short one, a kid's book.
So do you have any plans to do another film together?
I hope so.
What about walking the entire Camino de Santiago?
That's something both of us would love to do without a camera or a cell phone or a credit card.
But just or a crew really, following
or a crew. Just really.
And another book?
If this book were to be successful, which I hope it is, I would be inclined to consider an autobiography.
There are volumes of stories that didn't make it into this book, particularly about his activism, that could be an entire book in and of itself. And we just didn't feel, I mean, that would have been an 800-page book to include all of that, right?
Meanwhile, the picture on the cover has you, Martin, with a lot of dark hair, and you, Emilio, totally blonde.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
The both of you have switched.
It's curious because both my parents are dark-haired, and there I am, this little toe-headed.
When did it change?
Gosh, I'm going to say in my late teens.
Really, late?
Yeah.
Well, thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thanks, Lynn.
And when you write the next book or do a movie together, I hope you'll come back.
Thank you. We will do.
Along the Way, The Journey of a Father and Son is published by Free Press, and it was written in collaboration with Hope Edelman by Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Lynn.